I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest, Stanley Croucher, is a noisy know-it-all with a way of voicing his views in ways that start fights. Fights about Minister Louis Farrakhan, whom Crouch calls a nutcase, or about Miles Davis's descent from jazz into fusion at the end of his career, or about the writer James Baldwin's hysterical alienation, as Crouch called it, or about Marion Barry, the disgraced mayor of Washington, whom Crouch called the Negro American Nixon. But it's not all complaints and put-downs from Stanley Crouch, who has held forth at the Village Voice, the New York Daily News, and on 60 Minutes. He is himself a cheerful and accessible celebrant of black culture and American life. He was a founder of Jazz at Lincoln Center and a main tutor of its music director, Wynton Marsalis. Spiritually and intellectually, Stanley Crouch seems to have cast himself as a link between the generation of novelist Ralph Ellison and bandleader Duke Ellington and the next jazz generation, if there is to be one. In his first big novel titled Don't the Moon Look Lonesome, our guest Stanley Crouch has given himself room for riffs and rants in all directions, circling around a white jazz singer from South Dakota who's trying to save a serious love affair with a black saxophone star from Texas, all of it in New York. Carla, the woman's name, and Maxwell speak for what Stanley Crouch finds best in America, although in love and in this novel it's never easy. Connection listeners, make the Stanley Crouch connection at 1-800-423-8255. Stanley Crouch has painted himself a huge canvas here of all American characters, black, white, nasty, nice, noisy, every one of them. Give him a call at 1-800-423-8255. Or 1-800-423-TALK. And welcome, Stanley Crouch. This is a fascinating book. In your intellectual scheme of things, it ought to be easier between Carla and Maxwell, but it's not. What makes this kind of thing, male, female, black, white, so difficult in this country, in this year of our Lord 2000?
Well, in this particular case, Carla, who's from South Dakota and of Norwegian ancestry on both sides, and Maxwell, her guy, who's from Houston, Texas, black on both sides, but with mixtures in there, like most black Americans have. They're under pressure because he's become somewhat prominent, and before he became prominent, he wasn't paid that much attention to by black people in general or black women in particular. But as happens with black people who become known in a profession, if he or she decides to go marry, be with somebody from the other side of the fence, as it were, ethnically, then this starts to happen. Hmm. Oh, are there no black men good enough for you? Is that why you're married to this guy? Or, boy, look here, let me tell you something. You black men just cannot stay away from those white women. And every time one of you starts making some money or gets known, the first thing you do is run out and snatch one of those white girls. So before he became prominent, the first 4 years of their lives together, he was above race. He didn't care about it. He made jokes about it. He ignored it, etc. But once people start to converge on him on his jobs and clubs and the black women come around him and start talking with him intimately or attempting to, and are very rude to Carla, he starts to cave in. And so the story is about whether or not the two of them, who've had something that was based on each of them being an individual, is going to fall asunder because of group pressure.
It's falling asunder slowly, or trying to, or trying to be saved from it most of the way through this novel. There's a critical moment when he's on a bandstand in New York, and a woman comes up to him and says, "You brothers need to come on home," as though Carla was a stain on his tie that he needed to clean off. She says, "You got to come home and get something real. You know what I'm saying? Put some brown sugar in your coffee. That African sugar. It'll wake you up. That tired European ice milk is putting you brothers to sleep."
Yeah, well, guys have to hear that. I mean, that's almost a literal quote of something that was told to me, that, you know, with some guys. I mean, that happens. It's like that. And I think that one of the ironies...
How is it different from any other kind of flirtation on the bandstand or elsewhere?
Well, a certain kind of presumption takes place that irritates Carla, which is the fact that these women, most of whom are well-to-do and attractive black women, so it's not as though they're women who are uneducated or something like that. What she resents is the fact that they assume that in some way they own all of these guys. So it's kind of a black version of the white guys who used to assume that they owned all of the white women, and that anybody, that if a white woman was involved with anybody who wasn't white, that they felt free to come and tell her that, you know, she was betraying the group, so to speak, you know, and why couldn't she find a white guy to get with? Or how dare her? And so I think that one of the things that happens in the United States is that almost every group plays out the same variations. It's just a question of when they arrive. At one point in the book, people are talking about whether or not someday the guys in the rap industry will have the same fates that the worst Jewish gangsters, the worst Italian gangsters, the worst industrialists have had when their kids grow up and conclude that, Dad, you mean you polluted all of this and did all of that and broke all these strikes and this and that to become wealthy? I hate you. Or you did, you mean you killed people, you sold drugs, et cetera? I hate you. You mean you, I hate you. So one of the main characters, Leanne, says, well, it is possible that it could be an American variation. She said, because Negroes always do run a fast last.
We will get to Leanne. Leanne is a rich, beautiful model in this story. She's a great friend of Carla's. She's black, and she's a kind of, what should we say? She's a kind of truth teller. There's a she's a race woman. She's an everything woman, and a very, very colorful voice. We'll get to her, but there are other things here too I want to mention. Early on, there's I hear the kind of Crouch project being outlined. It reminds me also of your mentor, Albert Murray, but one of the characters says, this nation was everybody's. And he says, this country is just too big to worry about where you get your start. An echo of that omni-American theme of Albert Murray, that that the country is big enough for everybody, and it's also, we're also related in ways, more ways than we recognize. You like to quote Carl Jung saying that white Americans walk like Negroes, talk like Negroes, laugh like Negroes, dance like Negroes from a Swiss perspective.
Yeah, he was from where they make the real white people in Northern Europe.
Well, from that perspective. But make that point. How hard do you want to make it today in the year 2000 that we're still trying to recognize ourselves as one people?
Well, see, I think we do. See, what I think is very true is this, that many people, when they write about the United States, and by no means am I naive enough to think that racism has croaked and has been buried deeply in the ground. But when Oprah Winfrey's the most powerful person in the literary world.
Next to The Connection, you mean?
Well, just that second. Yes, she is. Running a fast last. In a two-person race. When Michael Jordan was the biggest, most popular athlete since Babe Ruth, when you have black mayors in almost every major city in the United States, you've got a black guy, whether they like his opinions or not, on the Supreme Court. Ron Brown rebuilt the Democratic Party that had been shattered and was, according to Clinton, almost single-handedly responsible for him becoming president. And on down the line, it's hard for me to accept the idea that the country is not expanding and is not embracing more different kinds of people. And, I mean, even if we look at television series, I mean, Americans are always trying to figure out a way to get more people in, whether people have certain kind of physical problems, I mean, they're these different people who appear in these TV shows, et cetera, and they endear themselves to the populace, and then people begin to say, oh, somebody with Down syndrome is not necessarily the worst kind of person in the world, or whatever it is. And what Don't the Moon Look Lonesome attempts to do is bring us up to date on what actually is going on with the complexity and variety of things that happen in the United States. Because I wanted to write a book, unlike books that I have read, in which Black people and white people are presented in their relationships to each other in very, very simple ways. And so I wanted to avoid simplistic stuff. I wanted to get away from stereotypic ideas about the Midwest, the South, the North, etc., and try to present a canvas that was worthy of the country. And I think that the country has plenty going for it. And as Carla discovers, as you know, because she goes through so many different social arenas, she discovers that there are people in each one of them she likes and people whom she can't stand. And it doesn't make any difference what their color is, what their class is, what their backgrounds happen to be, that as individuals, you come to recognize in other groups yourself, people you know, and places you've been.
I want to ask you the Stanley Crouch question behind the novel question. Although in the novel, jazz and music generally is a kind of medium for not only for self-discovery and expression, but it's a kind of medium for what I would call kind of rooted multiculturalism, people learning about each other in a kind of expansive way without losing themselves. I wonder. I mean, you embody this to me in lots and lots of ways. You're a very sort of rooted Black American guy with sophisticated, broad tastes in everything. How did you come by it? And how do you suggest other people might?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the way I was reared. I mean, my mother was born in 1917, moved to Los Angeles from Texas in 1936. I was born there in 1945, Los Angeles. And there was a Black elementary school in our neighborhood, and there was an integrated school about a mile and a half from our neighborhood. And so my mother said to me, my sister, and my brother, who hated it because we had to walk much farther to school than everybody else, she said, there are many different kinds of people in the world, and you might as well start meeting them now. So at the school, there were Chinese, Korean, Japanese kids, all of whom couldn't stand each other. There were Irish kids. There were Mexican kids. There were kids from the South, from Oklahoma, et cetera. So very early, so at the very beginning of school, I was meeting and going in the homes of all of these different people, some of whom cooked very different food than the others. But after a while, you started recognizing certain kinds of parents, certain kinds of kids, et cetera. And then I began to realize over the years that most of the arguments in life are really about the style that you choose to do something in, not the thing itself. Nobody will say you shouldn't eat food. They'll say you shouldn't eat this food, or you shouldn't eat the food this way. They won't say they won't necessarily say you shouldn't wear clothes. They'll say, oh, those clothes look horrible on you, or I'd never wear anything like that, or anyone who wears stuff like that shows that he or she has no taste. And on down the line it goes. And so most of my material over the years, once I grew up, is based upon constantly going back to the recognition that I had when I was a kid in school, and also back to what the Black people that I grew up around believed, which was that no one had the right to tell anybody else what to do, whom to be with, whom to marry, etc., that was the business of those individuals, and that no one could tell you who didn't know you what you could or couldn't do. And
can you say they didn't tell you? People said, I don't like that girl you're hanging with, or that guy, or that group, or what do you mean?
No, I mean, they wouldn't tell you on the basis of what somebody looked like. They wouldn't say, don't run around with those Chinese kids, those Mexicans are no good, etc. Their feeling was that those people were individuals. And I think it had to do with the fact that so many of them being from the South and having had the experience of just of being turned into abstractions by racism, that they really were very powerfully engaged in individuality. That didn't mean by at all that they weren't proud of Duke Ellington or Jackie Robinson or Marian Anderson or whomever it was. But their feeling was that the solutions were going to be, the human solutions were going to be brought about by individuals, and that the individuals should have the right to be individuals.
It's interesting. I wanted to ask you, who are your sort of models of that kind of omni-American transcendence? But I could almost tell them to you. I mean, even in this book, Jackie Kennedy, Onassis, Saul Bellow, Charlie Parker, Balzac, the French novelist, these things, these people recur in everything you write as kind of examples. But I wonder, who are the others that I'm missing? Who are the concrete models to you of a kind of where you think we ought to be aiming over our own heads?
Well, I think that the kinds of people who periodically disprove what people think. For instance, there's supposed to be this enormous hostility between black people and Jews in New York City, right? So there was this story that took place in which this Hasidic guy was going to a store. He was driving a van. He left his kids in the van. The van caught fire. And a couple of these young black guys who had those angular haircuts and chains around their necks broke into the van, saved the lives of the kids. So, of course, your prototypical how could this happen reporter says, why did you all do that? And the kid said, there were children in a van and the van was on fire, so we got them out of it. You know what I mean? It's like they weren't saying, oh, we're black, they're Jews, so we should just let them burn up or keep walking along. And that happens over and over in America in all kinds of different ways. And in my novel, what I'm trying to do is show that there are human connections, no matter what the surface differences of the styles might be, that almost invariably tell us that we're connected. And the human connections might not be good. Sometimes, I mean, it's one of the things I try to show in the book is that there's not that big a difference. In fact, there's none between some racist cops moving on a black guy for no reason, some totalitarians in East Berlin moving on a woman in East Berlin before the wall fell, and some gangbanger walking down the street who wants to impose his authority on an older guy by knocking a bag out of his hand and then showing him that he has his gun in his belt and that he's going to let him go. So what I try to do is just show that these traits are not, they're not based on race or place or class or anything like that, that they're human phenomena and that we share them, and that the worst elements, wherever they come from, we have to stand up against them.
What does music have to do with it?
Well, I mean, American music is a polyglot. I mean, it's part African, it's part European. There are Indian influences in it. There are Mexican influences. There are things that come from the Caribbean. And probably as more and more Asians come into American society, Asian traces of things may begin to become part of the mix. Because as you know, in one section in Don't the Moon Look Lonesome, when Carla goes with Maxwell's mother to the mall in Houston,
right,
she notices that all of these different people are brought together by what would be sneered at as just the commercial area of a mall. But what happens is that all these Vietnamese and Mexicans and black Americans and white Americans, they end up brought together and coming in contact with each other just by going to a place that most intellectuals from where I come from, New York City, where I live, would sneer at. A mall, nothing of significance could go on there. But in fact, something important is happening, that these people are dealing with each other.
You make it a more interesting mall than any mall I've met yet, but I'm going to keep looking.
Well, you need to go to a mall in Texas.
But there's another question about the music, too. Music in that mall, there's a kind of some sort of eclectic DJ has taken over the soundtrack, and he's playing everything.
Right.
European music and American music and high and low, the whole bit. And music is a great metaphor of a kind of universal possibility. At the same time, it's a maybe small question, but I always want to ask you, why is music, including every comment that you make on it, so ferociously contentious in this country? Even the legacy of Duke Ellington, people still want to draw blood arguing about it, not to mention your own attacks on Miles Davis, or on gangster rap for that matter, and people's attacks on you and Winton at Lincoln Center, there's a ferocity that comes out in the discussion of music, and I don't mean to put it down necessarily. It must be some sort of signal that the content of this argument is extremely important.
Well, I think it's because it's part of the way in which we define ourselves. One of the things that Americans know is that American music tends to influence the world at large. And it also tends to tell us, to some extent, who we are at particular times. And if it's good enough, then it has that timeless quality that allows us to hear something that came out of an earlier period and realize, as Picasso once pointed out, that something that is not always contemporary should never be considered at all. That is to say, if it ever was truly good, then it's good now. And I think that because we have a tradition in the United States that began in rebellion, we often have a confusion over what I call heroic individuality as opposed to anarchic individuality. In heroic individuality, as with a Lincoln or a King, this person's actions and decisions can bring about more freedom. In anarchic individuality, as say with Billy the Kid or some guy walking down the street with a pistol stuck in his belt, that person's individuality reduces freedom. And I think that the tensions that we see in music and in discussions of music in this country are connected to how we interpret either form of individuality arriving in somebody's lyrics and somebody's style of playing. And once you throw in the racial component, then you're back to the central problem that we have in the country, which is what is the real relationship between where somebody comes from and who that person as an individual really is. And somebody always wants to say, well, if you're from here, you can't do that. That's one of the reasons why Leontine Price appears in the novel a number of times, because she's from Laurel, Mississippi, and she's one of the great opera singers of the second half of the 20th century. And she's the same thing that Carla is. That is to say, Carla is not trying to be a black person. She's trying to find the way to express herself aesthetically. And the best way for her is to sing jazz and to sing blues. As the best way for Kathy Battle or for Leontine Price or Jesse Norman to be who each of them happens to be as an artist comes in that music. They're not trying to be European women or white women. No, that's not what they're trying to do. So that's one of the themes. And I think that that's because, you know, there was a time when it was considered almost sacrilegious for a black person to sing European Leader. That was what? These people late of the cotton fields, how dare they?
Roland Hayes did it, yeah. At a price. Which reminds me also that on practically every page of this novel, Stanley Crouch, there's some meditation or argument about what it means to swing and what the truth of blues feeling is all about. Do you want to do a little riff on either of those words and why they're so significant to you?
Well, the first thing is swing is a totally American rhythm. It doesn't exist in any other music. It's as American as aerodynamics. That is, no matter what anybody says, two bicycle mechanics of German descent were at Kitty Hawk, and they were the ones who got the first heavier-than-air object up into the sky, and it stayed there for a little while. Now, people come from all over the world swinging now. I mean, you can go to Italy, and you can hear some guys, you can hear people swinging from anywhere. But swing came out of the United States. And I think that it might have been the first totally modern way of phrasing music. And it's because the United States was born in the Industrial Revolution, America was a kid when the Industrial Revolution started.
Right.
So see, we So all of this stuff is natural to Americans. See, most European music was pastoral. And then when the music began to depict the cities, it usually depicted the cities as very dangerous, lonely, dark, corrupting kinds of places. But if you listen to Duke Ellington's Drop Me Off in Harlem, or any of those great songs that the Gershwin brothers wrote, I mean, you don't get this. You get the sense from Americans that, hey, you can handle the city. I mean, it's big, it's rough, it's tough. It might be gruff, but believe me, if you know how to swing, you can find your place in there, and you can, and it can seem to you as though the city is your city. And so, in Don't the Moon Look Lonesome, that's why New York City is one of the main characters. See, I learned that from Balzac. Paris is always a character in Balzac. And in this novel, New York City is one of the main characters.
Our guest, Danny Carter's novel is called Don't the Moon Look Lonesome, a novel in blues and swing. You've heard the swing riff. We'll do a little blues riff after the break. It's a huge canvas of American life in our time, black and white, all of it centered on music. A white singer from South Dakota, Carla, a black tenor saxophone star from Texas, Houston, Maxwell. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Join the conversation with Danny Crouch at 1-800-423-TALK. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. Christopher Lydon, this is The Connection, the Stanley Crouch Connection. Our guest, Stanley Crouch, is a man of many opinions. He'll share them all. He's put a whole lot of them in different voices in his first big novel. It's called Don't the Moon Look Lonesome. Make the connection at 1-800-423-8255. I wish you'd give us a taste of this novel, Stanley, in your own voice. Would you give us a little bit of Carla, perhaps? And then I'd love you to tell us what Leanne sounds like in your own head. She has some of the great orations in this book. A little Carla, if you will.
Carla felt neither shame nor regret about growing up where she did or evolving into the person that she had become. The merry message that Maxwell could only mock these days was American. That was it. This nation was everybody's. There was nothing at all wrong with being from Indian country, where she had a pre-adolescent fantasy of herself as a buckskin Lakota princess, wearing her sable hair in braids. On the ridge, sitting atop a wonderful pinto, only a blanket separating its muscular body from hers, the more reddish than brown princess thought of the crush and the grief she felt for her brave and fallen Indian warrior. He had died of measles, a sign of their world ending, which meant nothing to the millions of mindless buffalo way down east of the ridge, shaking the ground like an earthquake. Though these beasts would not live long either, it didn't seem that way then. They covered the land like humpback snow. There wasn't a blade of grass or an inch of earth visible in any direction down there. Only them, their fur, horns, and hooves. What that land and those skies had seen. Yes, thank Lord, her roots were all right with her. She could no longer be made to feel insecure or regretful about that. What she was had become obvious over the years. As an American girl, when she was still young and woozy, her mind impregnated by as many movies and books as any other citizen, she had also imagined herself a pioneer woman in a wagon train heading west and ending up in the Great Plains, ready to face the heartbreak of that pitiless landscape. Putting the guys in their place by being sure-shot Annie Oakley wasn't too bad either. her trigger finger and eye confounding the men who were so much stronger than she, but had to learn that it didn't take all the hurly-burly muscle and bubble gut to lift a rifle. Sorry, you half-blind gathering of polecats, this shooting iron doesn't know and doesn't give a hoot if I'm a girl. Or traveling by the stars that determine the path of the Underground Railroad and leading runaways through the swamp as Harriet Tubman, General Moses, was a super thrill to think about. What could you say? Maybe nothing is the best answer. This country is just too big to worry about where you get your start. You didn't vote on that in the womb anyway.
Well, that's fascinating. That's exactly what I thought introduced the sort of omni-American woman, Carla, at the start of the book. Would you give us some of a very different voice of Leanne, the model, an enormously successful, confident, mouthy, opinionated, sexy black female?
Oh, yeah, well, she's a...
An orator.
Yeah, she's making a... Here she's making fun of ethnocentricity. And so she's giving a fake speech to these people in a bar in Washington. She says, "Oh, don't let me get to going home to where my soul is. I feel a grass hut over my head this evening. I hear me some drums. I'm getting ancestral. I feel the slave ship swaying across the mighty Atlantic Ocean. Seemed just like yesterday. I feel the cries of the crammed and the damned. I smell the toe jam. I'm all the way back to the bushwhack. I feel a cotton sack on my tired black back. I'm feeling a feeling this evening. I'm talking about Daddy, Papa D-da-da, da-da, da homie. Down home with my homies is what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something actually black right now. I don't mean almost black. I don't mean half black. I don't mean nearly black. I don't mean passing for black. I'm talking about jazz. Did you hear what I said? Did those four letters bless my bones? Did they cut through the rainforest of your ignorance, my brothers and sisters? Spirit, come on down here and pop the whip on these people. Lift the whale from under that veil. Let them know. Let's get real snappy and all the way nappy. Jazz. That right there is the point. Black claimed by white. Help me, somebody. The white man. Oh, you got to watch him. You got to watch that carrot nose cracker now. You got to watch that blonde beast with a devil's tail poking out of the back of his pants. Oh, he's an evil thing. He'll get you to move, and then you'll lose, like at the Grammys, huh? Grammy, my mammy, then told me as a whammy. I mean, can you believe that these crackers got two categories now, gospel and soul gospel? That lets the white folks win in the category our people invented, and we supposed to be a black version of something that was black from the very beginning of the beginning. That's the white man. Oh, that's him. If it's good, the white man wants it. If it's better than good, he goes crazy. If it's great, he must take it away and claim it as his own and disown your black ass on a cloud of laughing gas. Tarzanism. Tarzanism. That's what he's about. Watch that cracker. He'll swing on those vines and yodel you out of business."
Stanley Crouch, in the voice of his character Leanne. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Stanley Crouch connection on the occasion of his novel, Don't the Moon Look Lonesome. 1-800-423-8255. Bronze is on the line.
How you doing, Chris?
Good, Bronze.
How you doing, Mr. Crouch, sir?
Fine, how are you?
Great, I enjoyed everything you said. What a thoroughly enjoyable conversation. But I wanted to ask you a question about what you said when you said that arguments are basically questions of style. I agree with you, and that style are questions of aesthetics. And if that's true, why would you choose to use the Lincoln Center as a venue, or the prism, if you would, to express your desire for black youths to reconnect to their jazz history?
Oh, I don't think that's the purpose of Jazz and Lincoln Center at all.
What is the purpose? The
purpose of Jazz and Lincoln Center is to produce in as many different versions as we can, and as well as we can, every high-quality rendition of jazz as decided primarily by the musical director and with input and suggestions from other people. So it doesn't matter whether it's the music of Dewey Redmond, Ornette Coleman, Louis Armstrong, Jelly Roll Morton, Dizzy Gillespie, Thelonious Monk, John Coltrane, Miles Davis, Tad Dameron, etc. That's what we're trying to do.
But don't you think that the Lincoln Center itself puts a sort of faux Europeanized authenticity on it, almost a haughtiness that jazz just doesn't need. Jazz is based on style, not haughtiness. Don't you?
Well, I don't know about haughty. I mean, what you need to do is go get some photographs of these guys like Jelly Roll Morton and Duke Ellington and all of those guys. They wore tuxedos. They played to all kinds of different audiences. So do the people at Jazz and Lincoln Center.
Yeah, but clothing is not what... I'm not saying anything about wearing a tuxedo or being stylish. I think stylishness is one of the great losses that black men have had in the since the 1980s. But and I believe that a lot of people who are involved in the Lincoln Center thing are, if nothing, stylish. But don't you think that when you move into, again, a Europeanized context, that you lose a lot of the authentic blues effect? And I'm from Alabama, so I kind of...
Well, no, I don't. No. Come on. I mean, Duke Ellington, Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, Jimmy Rushing, all of those people performed at Carnegie Hall in the greatest halls all over the world. It has nothing to do with it. That's like saying that something... Once black people start going and getting x-rays or have their blood put under microscopes or something, suddenly they've left the authentic world of black folk medicine. Yes, maybe so, but the thing is, none of those questions have anything to do with the arts. I mean, the point in the arts is whether or not the material sounds good. Hmm. I mean, it doesn't... This whole thing about Europeanized and the idea that is in some way supposed to mean that a quality of soul has been drained away is I think that's patently incorrect. That is because it's suggesting that the music is most real if it's only performed in gin joints, nightclubs, jam sessions, etc. It's what makes the music real is how well it's played, wherever it's played.
I wonder, Bronze, musically speaking, are you on to the Winton and Jazz at Lincoln Center program? Does it sound good to you or not?
I mean, I you cannot knock Mr. Marsalis' technical expressive talents. I mean, he's wonderful. But I think when a lot of people talk about the power of jazz since 1980, as opposed to the power of rap since 1980, I don't think it's that the technical skill of rap artists is greater than the technical skill of quote-unquote jazz artists, but I think that the rap artist's musical and artistic expression of the contemporary truth is real, and I don't necessarily think that the jazz artists are real, and when a jazz artist is real, he gets assaulted by the most of the mainstream jazz press. For example, a Roy Hargrove, who has definitely had some problems personally, but how can you question the guy's play? I mean, I think when I listen to Roy Hargrove, I really feel an artistic warmth and a genuineness that I haven't heard since I heard somebody like, say, a Miles Davis.
Well, you know, I think I'm with you, Bruns. Thank you.
Yeah, well, you know, we had Roy Hargrove had a concert at Lincoln Center, and he was commissioned to write a piece, and he performed it at the end. He sang some blues right up there in a tuxedo. So, I think that, you know, there is in this novel some discussion of rap, what it means, how it goes, etc. But quite frankly, I'm not somebody who can buy in a world that produces the enormous variety of black Americans that the United States does, that the very narrow concerns and fundamental simple-mindedness of most of these rappers is something that we have to look at as real. I mean, real what? It may be like Chris Rock says, real dumb.
What is its grip, do you think? Since, I mean, why is it more powerful in the marketplace than jazz?
Oh, well, I mean, pop stuff like that has always been more popular than everything else. I mean, but see, the rapper fits in a very traditional role in American culture, which is the minstrel show. There was a character in the minstrel show called Zip Coon, and he was the bad Negro from the streets who toted a razor and threatened people and acted wild and crazy, right? 150 years ago. Now you can turn on MTV, BET, and VH1 and see him strutting around and pulling on his genitals and cursing and acting crazy and talking crazy stuff now. So the only thing that's really changed is the technology and the paycheck. So, I mean, so people like Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre and those kinds of people, they make an enormous amount of money, but what they have to say isn't really very significant. I mean, people say it's real. Oh, you mean we're learning something when people say that bad people shoot other people? That drugs are sold, people sling crack. That's new information. We didn't, we, you know, that certain people think all women are bitches and whores, that women want to have sex, that women can be manipulated, that you, that if you shoot somebody in the head, he dies. I mean, I don't find that new information, really. And when people tell me that we're learning something about the way it really is, you can turn it on. You can look at Bill Curtis's investigative reports on some show about Compton for an hour, and I think you'll learn just about as much as you would from 50 hours of listening to rap recordings.
1-800-423-8255. The Stanley Crouch Connection. Charles is calling from Toronto, Canada.
Hey, how you doing, Mr. Crouch?
Fine. How are you?
Not too bad. I must say, I really enjoy reading you for a long time. Especially, I really enjoy reading you right now in Salon Magazine. And one of the things I just wanted to let you, ask your opinion on. I went to Howard University, and then I came back to Toronto here. And one of the things I'm noticing after, because one of the things I felt I needed was to immerse myself in kind of a more black environment. And when I came back here to Toronto, what I found is with a generation of young people now, I guess Generation X and younger, they're not seeing race as quite the way I think the generations before them see it. Because I see the way their interaction as far as things like interracial dating now. I guess, I don't know if it's because I live in Toronto and everything is a little bit more free and easy here, but I see that there's a general way of accepting things, not just interracial dating, but the whole multicultural aspect of life is just, I found it was a little bit more broad than when I was living in Washington, D.C. And I was wondering, do you find that in general now about that generation of young people?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that is something. In fact, there is more and more of a realization of a lot of the goals of the civil rights movement in a lot of younger people, because they like a lot of the same things. I mean, for instance, when Titanic was out, you could look at these lines of people there, and they'd be black couples, white couples. They'd seen the movie, the Asian, everybody was in the line. And they'd seen the movie two or three times, and they'd be standing in line talking about the scenes that they liked, et cetera. So I think that there is something that's going on. And Don't the Moon Look Lonesome, that's what I'm trying to get to, is that there's another body of information and a greater complexity of interaction across race and class than we tend to hear when people come on and give you those doom and gloom tales about, you know, black America and white America. See, I don't know where either one of those places is yet. I mean, I've heard about black America and white America for a long time, but I've never been able to isolate where each one of them is.
1-800-423-8255, the Stanley Crouch Connection. Roger is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Hello, Roger. Welcome.
Hi, Stanley.
Hi, how you doing?
I just want to ask you, what is the deal with Nina Simone? And
I was going to ask you, Roger.
Well, listen, Nina Simone was a guest on this program a few days ago.
No, she's never a guest.
Pardon me?
No, she's never a guest.
She's never a guest. She's a doctor.
She's a problem.
I believe it is. Yeah. But she spent about 50% of the interview complaining about race relations and saying, quote unquote, that nothing has changed in 30 years. And she complained that the royalties that she had lost on her recordings due to international piracy were all due to racism. And she went on in this vein. And Chris did little or nothing to challenge her on these points. And I want to ask you, what is going on there?
Well, first of all, correction, 50% of the time she wasn't here. she got here middle of the program, and she gave short answers to every question, Roger. You're right about that.
Emphatic answers.
No, you quote her correctly, I think. What's your take, Stanley Crouch?
Well, one of the things that is in it that this novel is about is that many things have changed. And that there are people who do very, very well. Chris and I were talking about earlier, Leanne, the fashion model from South Carolina, she was going to be an English teacher. Somebody took some photographs of her, and she went into the world of high fashion. But she's as connected to her roots, quote unquote, as anybody can be, because I wanted her to be a rejoinder to that very argument that these people make, that nothing has ever changed. Nothing has changed. It's exactly the way it's always been. But the people who usually say that, ironically, are usually the black people who are doing very well. I doubt that Nina Simone walked over here to the studio. I doubt that she was wearing a dress or any kind of clothing that cost less than $500. I doubt that she was not in a limousine. And she also had bodyguards. Now, if you studied careers of Billie Holiday and a lot of those kind of people, they weren't necessarily traveling to interviews in limousines with bodyguards and very expensive clothes. She's been living abroad for years. And she may well have a case about being cheated in the record business, but she's not the only person who was ever cheated in the record business. I mean, many people have been cheated in the record business because one aspect of business when bad people get in charge is that they steal your money.
Roger, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the Stanley Crouch Connection. Nancy is on the cell phone in New Hampshire.
Hi, Stanley. Hi, Christopher.
Hello, Nancy.
I'm so frustrated. My cell phone broke down yesterday, and I wanted to call about poetry. But today, this really strikes home even more. I sat next to Nina Simone at the Newport Jazz Festival 25, 30 years ago. And she wasn't in a limousine, and she was just sitting next to me, and that was a big thrill for me. But I certainly can relate to Carla. I'm a white girl who loves to sing the blues. I lived in a town that had underground tunnels going to the ocean for the Underground Railroad.
Wow. I
was in a production in this very upscale Massachusetts seacoast town called Conversations with Women I've Known About Men They've Known, written by a black man talking to Asian women, Spanish women, Irish women, and it was performed in Marblehead and to a great audience. So I think you were right, Stanley. I'm sorry to ramble on, but it is about the music. I sing blues. I go to Jamaica. The people there say, woman, your voice is in the wrong body. You're exactly right about what you're saying, and I love what you've been telling people, and I can't wait to read the book.
Oh, thank you very much.
I think you're in it, Nancy. Thank you for calling 1-800-423-8255. Bob is calling from Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
Great show. Can you hear me? I'm in a phone booth here.
We're doing fine, Bob. Thank
you. Okay, great.
Thanks for calling.
Okay, Stanley. Great conversation, great topic. My situation, and I'm a white guy, older, still play basketball, and my question pertains to sports and some of these racial issues that you're talking about, primarily how what image people are portraying out there, primarily blacks in the sport industry and also the music industry, this kind of pimp and whore mentality that you see in the music industry. My daughters are watching this stuff right now, and I try to explain to them when I was a kid, the message coming out of the inner cities was more hopeful. We were all into the city music, but it wasn't just, again, the gangster mentality, and how it pertains to sports. I see that a lot, and I see a lot of reverse racism, if you so to speak, this division between black players and white players and different treatment and different styles, I guess you'd say. I'm in a bad spot, so I'm going
to... Sharpen the question, Bob. What is it you want Stanley Crouch to address?
Okay, what I want Stanley to address is... what is the image that he thinks is being portrayed by this kind of gangster rap and the pimp and whore mentality?
Well, fair enough.
I say how girls are being portrayed and young women are being portrayed in these videos and how that affects young people of both black and white.
You left Stanley Crouch 1 minute to wrap it up. Bob,
okay.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things that happens in Don't the Moon Look Lonesome is that Carla is on a train and all of these rowdy black kids come in after school is let out and everybody on the train gets terrified, and then four real thugs come on and everybody gets quiet, including the rowdy kids, and she comes to realize that all of these black kids are acting. So unfortunately, the image that these black kids are taking to assault society, that's their version of what the white kids do with the green hair and the pink hair and all of that. And so she realizes that it's a style and it's one that helps to pollute race relations. But I think once we realize that they're acting, we can move past it quicker.
Bob in Pittsfield, thank you. Stanley Crouch, thank you enormously for joining us on The Connection. I hope you'll do it again. The book is Don't the Moon Look Lonesome. We had help today from Glenn Alexander, Dan First, Jake Shapiro, Daniel Springer, Gavin Steckler, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hatti, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. At 1 p.m. today, join WBUR's Bob Oakes and Monica Brady on assignment in Kosovo for an online live discussion.